Many people who live there no longer notice the smell. It recedes into the background, present but not present, like the sound of traffic for New Yorkers. Others can't stop thinking about the smell. Even after years, it permeates everything, gives them headaches, makes them nauseous, interferes with their sleep. Greeley is a modern-day factory town where cattle are the main units of production, where workers and machines turn large steer into small vacuum-sealed packages of meat. The billions of fast food hamburgers that Americans now eat every year come from places like Greeley. The industrialization of cattle raising and meat packing over the past two decades has completely altered how beef is produced and the towns that produce it. Responding to the demands of the fast food and food supermarket chains, the meat packing giants have cut costs by cutting wages. They have turned one of the nation's best-paying manufacturing jobs into one of the lowest-paying, created a migrant industrial workforce of poor immigrants, tolerated high injury rates, and spawned rural ghettos in the American heartland. Crime, poverty, drug abuse, and homelessness have lately taken root in towns where you'd least expect to find them. The effects of this new meatpacking regime have become as inescapable as the odors that drift from its feedlots, rendering plants, and pools of slaughterhouse waste. The ConAgra Beef Company runs the nation's biggest meatpacking complex, just a few miles north of downtown Greeley. Weld County, which includes Greeley, earns more money every year from livestock products than any other county in the United States. ConAgra is the largest private employer in Weld County, running a beef slaughterhouse and a sheep slaughterhouse, as well as rendering and processing facilities. To supply the beef slaughterhouse, ConAgra operates a pair of enormous feedlots. Each of them can hold up to 100,000 head of cattle. At times, the animals are crowded so closely together, it looks like a sea of cattle, a mooing, moving mass of brown and white fur that goes on for acres. These cattle don't eat blue grama and buffalo grass off the prairie. During the 3 months before slaughter, they eat surplus grain dumped into long concrete troughs that resemble highway dividers. The grain fattens the cattle quickly, aided by the anabolic steroids implanted in their ear. A typical steer will consume more than 3,000 pounds of grain during its stay at a feedlot, just to gain 400 pounds in weight. The process involves a fair amount of waste. Each steer deposits about 50 pounds of manure every day. Unlike human waste, this manure is not sent to a treatment plant. It's dumped into pits, huge pools of excrement that the industry calls lagoons. The amount of waste left by the cattle that pass through Weld County is staggering. The two Monfort feedlots outside Greeley produce more excrement than the cities of Denver, Boston, Atlanta, and St. Louis combined. Before Greeley became a meatpacking town, it was a utopian community of small farmers. It was founded in 1870 by Nathan Meeker, a newspaper editor from New York City, who wanted to create a city in the American West dedicated to agriculture, education, mutual aid, and high moral values. Meeker named the idealistic new settlement after his boss at the New York Tribune, Horace Greeley, who had given some career advice that proved legendary. Go West, young man. The town of Greeley, Colorado eventually thrived, becoming a major producer of beans and sugar beets. But Nathan Meeker did not live long enough to enjoy its success. In 1879, Meeker got into a dispute with a group of Ute Indians who killed him and then scalped him. For many years, the farmers of Greeley held themselves apart from local ranchers, at one point building a wooden fence around the town to keep cattle out, a fence 50 miles long. During the Depression, when commodity prices hit rock bottom, a Greeley schoolteacher named Warren Monfort started to buy grain from local farmers and feed it to his cattle. At the time, American cattle were mainly grass-fed, not grain-fed. They roamed the range, eating native grasses, or they lived on farms and ate hay. Munford soon became one of the nation's first large-scale cattle feeders, buying cheap corn, sugar beets, and alfalfa from his neighbors. His feedlot business greatly expanded after World War II. By feeding cattle year-round, Munford could control the timing of his livestock sales and wait for the best prices at the Chicago stockyards. The meat of grain-fed beef was fatty and tender. Unlike grass-fed beef, it did not need to be aged for a few weeks. It could be eaten within days of the slaughter. Feedlots began to open throughout the rural Midwest. American grain surpluses, largely fueled by government price supports, provided inexpensive food for livestock and made cattle feeding a standard practice in the beef industry. Warren Munford started his business in the 1930s with 18 head of cattle. By the late 1950s, he was feeding about 20,000. In 1960, Munford and his son Kenneth opened a small slaughterhouse in Greeley near his feedlots. They signed a generous union contract with the Amalgamated Butcher Workmen, granting benefits like seniority rights and pay bonuses for work on the late shift. Jobs at the Munford Slaughterhouse were among the highest paying in Greeley, and there was a long waiting list of people seeking work at the plant. Greeley became a company town, dominated by the Munford family, and ruled with a compassionate paternalism. The prosperity and labor peace in Greeley, however, were soon threatened by fundamental changes sweeping through the meatpacking industry, an upheaval that came to be known as the IBP Revolution. When the slaughterhouse in Greeley first opened, its rural location was unusual. Meatpacking plants were much more likely to be found in urban areas. Most large American cities had a meatpacking district with its own stockyards and slaughterhouses. Cattle were shipped there by rail, slaughtered, carved into sides of beef, then sold to local butchers and wholesalers. Omaha and Kansas City were prominent meatpacking towns, and the United Nations building now stands on land once occupied by New York City's stockyards. For more than a century, however, Chicago reigned as the meatpacking capital of the world. The Beef Trust was born there, the major meatpacking firms were headquartered there, and roughly 40,000 people were employed there in a square-mile meat district anchored by the Union stockyards. Refrigerated sides of beef were shipped from Chicago not only throughout the United States, but also throughout Europe. At the dawn of the 20th century, Upton Sinclair considered Chicago's packing town to be the greatest aggregation of labor and capital ever gathered in one place. It was, in his view, the supreme achievement of American capitalism, as well as its greatest disgrace. The old Chicago slaughterhouses were usually brick buildings, 4 or 5 stories high. Cattle were herded up wooden ramps to the top floor, where they were struck on the head with a sledgehammer, slaughtered, then disassembled by skilled workers. The animals eventually left the building on the ground floor, coming out as sides of beef, cans of beef, or boxes of sausage, ready to be loaded into rail cars. The working conditions in these meatpacking plants were brutal. In The Jungle, 1906, Upton Sinclair described a litany of horrors: severe back and shoulder injuries, lacerations, amputations, exposure to dangerous chemicals, and, memorably, a workplace accident in which a man fell into a vat and got turned into lard. The plant kept running, and the lard was sold to unsuspecting consumers. Human beings, Sinclair argued, had been made cogs in the great packing machine, easily replaced and entirely disposable. President Theodore Roosevelt ordered an independent investigation of The Jungle's sensational details. The accuracy of the book was confirmed by federal investigators, who found that Chicago's meatpacking workers labored under conditions that are entirely unnecessary and unpardonable, and which are a constant menace not only to their own health, but to the health of those who use the food products prepared by them. The popular outrage inspired by The Jungle led Congress to enact food safety legislation in 1906. Little was done, however, to improve the lives of packing house workers, whose misfortune had inspired Upton Sinclair to write the book. For the next 30 years, Unions battled to gain representation among Chicago's stockyard and slaughterhouse workers, who were mainly Eastern European immigrants. The large meatpacking firms used company spies, blacklists, and African American strikebreakers to thwart organizing efforts. Nevertheless, most of Chicago's packing house workers had gained union representation by the end of the Depression. After World War II, their wages greatly improved, soon exceeding the national average for workers in manufacturing. Meatpacking was still a back-breaking, dangerous job, but for many, it was also a well-paid and desirable one. It provided a stable middle-class income. Swift & Company, the largest firm in the industry until the early 1960s, was also the last of the Big Five meatpackers to remain privately controlled. In 1960, Courier J. Holman and A.D. Anderson, two former Swift executives, decided to start their own meatpacking company, convinced that by slashing costs, they could compete with the industry giants. The following year, Iowa Beef Packers opened its first slaughterhouse, a meat factory that, in its own way, proved as influential as the first speedy service McDonald's in San Bernardino. Applying the same labor principles to meatpacking that the McDonald brothers had applied to making hamburgers, Holman and Anderson designed a production system for their slaughterhouse in Denison, Iowa, that eliminated the need for skilled workers. The new IBP plant was a one-story structure with a disassembly line. Each worker stood in one spot along the line, performing the same simple task over and over again, making the same knife cut thousands of times during an 8-hour shift. The gains that meatpacking workers had made since the days of the jungle stood in the way of IBP's new system, whose success depended upon access to a cheap and powerless workforce. At the dawn of the fast food era, IBP became a meatpacking company with a fast food mentality, obsessed with throughput, efficiency, centralization, and control. "We've tried to take the skill out of every step," A.D. Anderson later boasted. In addition to creating a mass production system that employed a de-skilled workforce, IBP put its new slaughterhouses in rural areas close to the feedlots and far away from the urban strongholds of the nation's labor unions. The new interstate highway system made it possible to rely upon trucks instead of railroads to ship meat. In 1967, IBP opened a large plant in Dakota City, Nebraska, that not only slaughtered cattle, but also fabricated them into smaller cuts of meat, into primals, chucks, loins, ribs, rounds, and subprimals, such as chuck rolls. Instead of shipping whole sides of beef, IBP shipped these smaller cuts, vacuum-sealed and plastic-wrapped, as boxed beef. This new way of marketing beef enabled supermarkets to fire most of their skilled, unionized butchers. It also left IBP with a great deal of leftover bones, blood, and scraps of meat that could be rendered into profitable byproducts, such as dog food. IBP soon added grinders to its plants, machinery that made hamburger meat in enormous quantities, driving small processors and wholesalers out of business. The company's low wages and new production techniques transformed the entire beef industry, from the feedlot to the butcher counter. The IBP revolution was guided by a hard, unsentimental view of the world. Amid a packing house culture that valued toughness, Courier J. Holman took pride in being tougher than anyone else. He didn't like unions and didn't hesitate to do whatever seemed necessary to break them. IBP should always conduct business, Holman argued, as though it were waging war. When workers at the IBP plant in Dakota City went on strike in 1969, Holman hired scabs to replace them. The striking workers responded by firing a bullet through Holman's office window, killing a suspected company spy, and bombing the home of IBP's general counsel. Confronted with a real war, Holman sought assistance from an unusually powerful ally. In the spring of 1970, Holman and three other top IBP executives held secret meetings in New York City with Moe Steinman, a labor consultant who had close ties with La Cosa Nostra. Unionized butchers in New York were blocking the sale of IBP's boxed beef out of solidarity with the striking workers and fear for their own jobs. IBP was eager to ship its products to the New York metropolitan area, the nation's largest market for beef. Mo Steinman offered to help end the butcher's boycott and in return demanded a 5-cent commission on every 10 pounds of beef that IBP sold in New York. IBP planned to ship hundreds of millions of pounds of beef to New York City every year. Courier Jay Holman agreed to pay the mob its 5-cent commission, and the leaders of New York's butcher union promptly withdrew their objections to IBP's boxed beef. Shipments of IBP meat were soon being unloaded in Manhattan. After a lengthy investigation of mob involvement in the New York City meat business, Courier Jay Holman and IBP were tried and convicted in 1974 for bribing union leaders and meat wholesalers. Judge Burton Roberts fined IBP $7,000, but did not punish Holman with any prison term or fine, noting that bribes were sometimes part of the cost of doing business in New York City. Holman's links to organized crime, however, extended far beyond the sort of payments that honest New York businessmen were often forced to make. He appointed one of Mo Steinman's friends to the board of IBP, a man who a decade earlier had been imprisoned for bribing meat inspectors and for selling tainted meat to the U.S. Army, and made Steinman's son-in-law a group vice president of IBP, head of the company's processing division, even though the son-in-law, in Judge Roberts' words, knew virtually nothing about the meat business. And Holman forced out four top IBP executives who opposed dealing with organized crime figures. Subsequent investigations by Forbes and the Wall Street Journal cited IBP as a prime example of how a mainstream corporation could be infiltrated by the mob. The relentless low-cost competition from IBP presented old-line Chicago meat packers with a stark choice: go west or go out of business. Instead of symbolizing democracy and freedom, going west meant getting cheap labor. One by one, the packing houses in Chicago closed down, and slaughterhouses were built in rural states hostile toward labor unions. The new meatpacking plants in Iowa, Kansas, Texas, Colorado, and Nebraska followed IBP's example, paying wages that were sometimes more than 50% lower than what union workers earned in Chicago. During the 1970s, the cordial relationship between Monfort executives and workers at the Greeley Slaughterhouse came to an end. The underlying source of conflict was straightforward. Monfort wanted to reduce labor costs, but its workers thought that wages should not be cut at a time when the company was earning profits and the nation's annual inflation rate had reached double digits. In the midst of contract talks with Greeley workers in 1979, who were now represented by the UFCW, Ken Monfort purchased a slaughterhouse in Grand Island, Nebraska from Swift & Company. Before handing over the plant, Swift shut it down and fired all of the workers, who also belonged to the UFCW. When Monfort took control of the slaughterhouse a few weeks later, he signed a sweetheart deal with the National Maritime Union, a group that had never before represented meatpacking workers and that quickly agreed to a large pay cut. In November of 1979, the workers in Greeley went on strike. Monfort refused to meet their demands, and the dispute became ugly. The company began to hire scabs. Ken Monfort received death threats. 8 weeks after going on strike, the workers decided to return to their jobs without a contract, but riot police prevented them from entering the slaughterhouse. When the company allowed workers back into the plant, many of them disobeyed supervisors and committed acts of sabotage. After a few months of industrial anarchy, Monfort closed the Greeley slaughterhouse and fired all its workers. The days of paternalism were over in Greeley. In 1982, the slaughterhouse in Greeley reopened without a union, paying wages that had been cut by 40%. Former workers were not offered jobs. Instead, Monfort transferred some employees from its Grand Island plant and hired new ones. Although Ken Monfort decided to follow IBP's tough policy on labor unions, he strongly resisted the increasing consolidation of the meatpacking industry. During the early 1980s, one independent meatpacker after another either went out of business or was purchased by a large corporate rival. In 1983, Monfort sued Excel, the nation's second largest beef processor, to prevent it from acquiring Spencer Beef, the nation's third largest beef processor. Monfort argued that the proposed acquisition would allow Excel to engage in predatory pricing and to reduce competition. A panel of federal judges ruled in favor of Monfort, but Excel appealed their decision to the U.S. Supreme Court. President Reagan's Justice Department submitted a brief in the case and argued on behalf of Excel, claiming it had every right to buy a rival company. The Reagan administration did not oppose the disappearance of hundreds of small meatpacking firms. On the contrary, it opposed using antitrust laws to stop the giant meatpackers. In 1986, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the earlier ruling and approved the merger of America's second and third largest meatpacking companies. The following year, Monfort agreed to a friendly takeover by ConAgra. It seemed to me that if the industry was going to be concentrated, Ken Monfort explained, there should be at least three large players instead of just two. As part of the deal, he became a top executive at the company, head of the ConAgra Red Meat Division, and his family received about $270 million in ConAgra stock. By purchasing Monfort, ConAgra became the biggest meatpacker in the world. Today, it's the largest food service supplier in North America. In addition to being the number one producer of French fries through its Lamb Western subsidiary, ConAgra is also the nation's largest sheep and turkey processor, the largest distributor of agricultural chemicals, the second largest manufacturer of frozen food, the second largest flour miller, the third largest chicken and pork processor, as well as a leading seed producer, feed producer, and commodity futures trader. The company sells its food under about 100 consumer brand names, including Hunt's, Armour, LaCroix, Country Pride, Swiss Miss, Orville Redenbacher's, Ready Whip, Taste of Sea, Knott's Berry Farm, Hebrew National, and Healthy Choice. Although few Americans have heard of ConAgra, they're likely to eat at least one of its products every day. 20 years ago, ConAgra, a combination of two Latin words whose intended meaning is partnership with the land, was an obscure Nebraska company with annual revenues of about $500 million. Last year, ConAgra's revenues exceeded $25 billion. The company's phenomenal growth over the past two decades was driven by the entrepreneurial spirit of its longtime chief executive, Charles Mike Harper. When Harper took over ConAgra in 1974, it was losing money. The market value of its stock was $10 million, and the value of its debt was $156 million. According to the company's official history, ConAgra Who, 1989, Harper promptly instituted a new corporate philosophy. Harper told each general manager that he'd been given a bag of money, the company history explains, and that at the end of the year, he'd be expected to return it, plus a little extra. The intense pressure to return a bigger bag of money every year has prompted a number of ConAgra employees to break the law. In 1989, ConAgra was found guilty in federal court of having systematically cheated chicken growers in Alabama. During an eight-year period, 45,256 truckloads of full-grown birds were deliberately misweighed at a ConAgra processing plant in the state. In 1995, ConAgra agreed to pay $13.6 million to settle a class action lawsuit that accused the company of having conspired with seven other firms to fix prices in the catfish industry. In 1997, ConAgra paid $8.3 million in fines and pleaded guilty in federal court to charges involving wire fraud, the misgrading of crops, and the addition of water to grain. Having broken the union at the Greeley Slaughterhouse, Montfort began to employ a different sort of worker there, recent immigrants, many of them illegals. In the 1980s, large numbers of young men and women from Mexico, Central America, and Southeast Asia started traveling to rural Colorado. Meatpacking jobs that had once provided a middle-class American life now offered little more than poverty wages. Instead of a waiting list, the slaughterhouse seemed to acquire a revolving door as Montfort plowed through new hires to fill the roughly 900 jobs. During one 18-month period, more than 5,000 different people were employed at the Greeley beef plant, an annual turnover rate of about 400%. The average worker quit or was fired every 3 months. Today, roughly two-thirds of the workers at the beef plant in Greeley cannot speak English. Most of them are Mexican immigrants who live in places like the River Park Mobile Court, a collection of battered old trailers a quarter mile down the road from the slaughterhouse. They share rooms in old motels, sleeping on mattresses that cover the floor. The basic pay at the slaughterhouse is now $9.25 an hour. Adjusted for inflation, today's hourly wage is more than a third lower than what Montfort paid 40 years ago when the plant opened. Health insurance is now offered to workers after 6 months on the job, vacation pay after a year, but most of the workers will never get that vacation. A spokesman for ConAgra recently acknowledged that the turnover rate at the Greeley slaughterhouse is about 80% a year. That figure actually represents a decline from the early 1990s. Mike Cohn candidly discussed the whole subject during a 1994 interview with Business Insurance, an industry trade journal. At the time, he was the corporate safety director of ConAgra Red Meat. There is a 100% turnover rate annually, Cohn said, in an article that applauded Montfort's skill at keeping its insurance costs low. Far from being a liability, a high turnover rate in the meatpacking industry, as in the fast food industry, also helps maintain a workforce that is harder to unionize and much easier to control. For more than a century, California agriculture has been dependent on migrant workers, on young men and women from rural villages in Mexico who travel north to pick by hand most of the state's fruits and vegetables. Migrant workers have long played an important role in the agricultural economy of other states, picking berries in Oregon, apples in Washington, and tomatoes in Florida. Today, the United States, for the first time in its history, has begun to rely on a migrant industrial workforce. Thousands of new migrants now travel north to work in the slaughterhouses and meat processing plants of the High Plains. Some of these new migrants save their earnings, then return home. Some try to establish roots and settle in meatpacking communities. And others wander the country, briefly employed in one state after another, looking for a meatpacking plant that treats its workers well. These migrants come mainly from Mexico, Guatemala, and El Salvador. Many were once farmers in California, where steady jobs in the fields are now difficult to find. To farm workers who've labored outdoors 10 hours a day for the nation's lowest wages, meatpacking jobs often sound too good to be true. Picking strawberries in California pays about $5.50 an hour, while cutting meat in a Colorado or Nebraska slaughterhouse can pay almost twice that amount. In many parts of rural Mexico and Guatemala, workers earn about $5 a day. As in so many other aspects of meatpacking, IBP was a trailblazer in recruiting migrant labor. The company was among the first to recognize that recent immigrants would work for lower wages than American citizens and would be more reluctant to join unions. To sustain the flow of new workers into IBP slaughterhouses, the company has for years dispatched recruiting teams to poor communities throughout the United States. It has recruited refugees and asylum seekers from Laos and Bosnia. It has recruited homeless people living at shelters in New York, New Jersey, California, North Carolina, and Rhode Island. It has hired buses to import these workers from thousands of miles away. IBP now maintains a labor office in Mexico City, runs ads on Mexican radio stations offering jobs in the United States, and operates a bus service from rural Mexico to the heartland of America. The Immigration and Naturalization Service estimates that about one quarter of all meatpacking workers in Iowa and Nebraska are illegal immigrants. The proportion at some slaughterhouses can be much higher. Spokesmen for IBP and the ConAgra Beef Company adamantly deny that they in any way seek illegal immigrants. "We do not knowingly hire undocumented workers," an IBP executive told me. "IBP supports INS efforts to enforce the law and does not want to employ people who are not authorized to work in the United States." Nevertheless, the recruiting efforts of the American meatpacking industry now target some of the most impoverished and most vulnerable groups in the Western Hemisphere. "If they've got a pulse," one meatpacking executive joked to the Omaha World Herald in 1998, "we'll take an application." The real costs of this migrant industrial workforce are being borne not by the large meatpacking firms, but by the nation's meatpacking communities. Poor workers without health insurance drive up local medical costs. Drug dealers prey on recent immigrants, and the large transient population usually brings more crime. The changes that have swept through Greeley, Colorado, have also occurred throughout the High Plains, wherever large meatpacking plants operate. Towns like Garden City, Kansas, Grand Island, Nebraska, and Storm Lake, Iowa, now have their own rural ghettos, drugs, poverty, rootlessness, and crime. Some of the most dramatic changes have occurred in Lexington, Nebraska, a small town about 3 hours west of Omaha. Lexington looks like the sort of place that Norman Rockwell liked to paint. Shade trees, picket fences, modest Victorian homes, comfy chairs on front porches. The appearance is deceiving. In 1990, IBP opened a slaughterhouse in Lexington. A year later, the town, with a population of roughly 7,000, had the highest crime rate in the state of Nebraska. Within a decade, the number of serious crimes doubled. The number of Medicaid cases nearly doubled. Lexington became a major distribution center for illegal drugs. Gang members appeared in town and committed drive-by shootings. The majority of Lexington's white inhabitants moved elsewhere, and the proportion of Latino inhabitants increased more than tenfold, climbing to over 50%. Mexington, as it's now called, affectionately by some, disparagingly by others, is an entirely new kind of American town, one that's been transfigured to meet the needs of a modern slaughterhouse. You would never think, driving past the IBP plant in Lexington, with its colorful children's playground out front, with Walmart and Burger King across the street, that a single innocuous-looking building could be responsible for so much sudden change, hardship, and despair. In Lexington, I met a cross-section of IBP workers. I met Guatemalan Indians who spoke no English and barely spoke Spanish, living in a dark basement strewn with garbage and used diapers. I met Mexican farm workers struggling to get used to the long Nebraska winters. I met one IBP worker who'd recently been a housekeeper in Santa Monica, and another whose previous job was collecting manure from fields in rural Mexico and selling it as fertilizer. I met hard-working, illiterate, religious people willing to risk injury and endure pain for the benefit of their families. The smell that permeates Lexington is even worse than the smell of Greeley. "We have three odors," a Lexington resident told a reporter: burning hair and blood, that greasy smell, and the odor of rotten eggs. Hydrogen sulfide is the gas responsible for the rotten egg smell. It rises from slaughterhouse wastewater lagoons, causes respiratory problems and headaches, and at high levels can cause permanent damage to the nervous system. In January of 2000, the Justice Department sued IBP for violations of the Clean Air Act at its Dakota City plant, where as much as a ton of hydrogen sulfide was being released into the air every day. As part of a consent decree, IBP agreed to cover its wastewater lagoons there. This agreement means that Nebraskans will no longer be forced to inhale IBP's toxic emissions, a Justice Department official? As of this writing, IBP is also preparing to cover its Lexington wastewater lagoons. On July 7, 1988, IBP held a public forum at a junior high school in Lexington, giving local citizens an opportunity to ask questions about the company's proposal to build a slaughterhouse there. The transcript of this meeting says a lot about how IBP views the rural communities where it operates. Would there be much turnover among workers at the new IBP plant? Someone asked. Once the slaughterhouse was running, an IBP executive replied, it would have a stable workforce. 90% of our people, he said, or 80%, will be fairly stable. Would local people be hired for these jobs? Someone else asked. We will not bring in an hourly workforce, the IBP executive promised. A local IBP booster, who had just returned from a visit to the company's slaughterhouse in Emporia, Kansas, suggested that there was little reason to worry about the type of people the plant might attract or the potential for increased crime. He said that in Emporia, apparently, they work them so hard at IBP that they're tired and they go home and go to bed. An IBP executive, a vice president of public relations, confirmed that assessment. And people who work on our lines work hard, he told the gathering. As the chief of police in Emporia said, they go home at night and go to bed rather than carouse around town. Another IBP executive, a vice president of engineering, assured the audience that the new plant in Lexington would not foul the air. No odor would be noticeable, he promised, even a few feet away from the plant. In any event, the smell emitted by slaughterhouse lagoons would be sweet, not objectionable. And the smell from the slaughterhouse itself, the IBP vice president said, would be no different than that which you produce in your kitchen when you cook. The most dangerous job. One night, I visit a slaughterhouse somewhere in the High Plains. The slaughterhouse is one of the nation's largest. About 5,000 head of cattle enter it every day, single file, and leave in a different form. Someone who has access to the plant, who's upset by its working conditions, offers to give me a tour. The slaughterhouse is an immense building, gray and square, about three stories high, with no windows on the front and no architectural clues to what's happening inside. My friend gives me a chainmail apron and gloves, suggesting I try them on. Workers on the line wear about 8 pounds of chainmail beneath their white coats, shiny steel armor that covers their hands, wrists, stomach, and back. The chainmail's designed to protect workers from cutting themselves and from being cut by other workers, but knives somehow manage to get past it. My host hands me some Wellingtons, the kind of knee-high rubber boots that English gentlemen wear in the countryside. Tuck your pants into the boots, he says. We'll be walking through some blood. I put on a hard hat and climb a stairway. The sounds get louder, factory sounds, the noise of power tools and machinery, bursts of compressed air. We start at the end of the line, the fabricating room. Workers call it fab. When we step inside, fab seems familiar. Steel catwalks, pipes along the walls, a vast room, a maze of conveyor belts. This could be the Lamb Weston plant in Idaho, except hunks of red meat ride the belts instead of French fries. Some machines assemble cardboard boxes, others vacuum seal subprimals of beef and clear plastic. The workers look extremely busy, but there's nothing unsettling about this part of the plant. You see meat like this all the time in the back of your local supermarket. The fab room is cooled to about 40 degrees, and as you head up the line, the feel of the place starts to change. The pieces of meat get bigger. Workers, about half of them women, almost all of them young and Latino, slice meat with long, slender knives. They stand at a table that's chest high, grab meat off a conveyor belt, trim away fat, throw meat back on the belt, toss the scraps onto a conveyor belt above them, and then grab more meat, all in a matter of seconds. I'm now struck by how many workers there are, hundreds of them pressed close together, constantly moving, slicing. You see hard hats, white coats, flashes of steel. Nobody is smiling or chatting. They're too busy, anxiously trying not to fall behind. An old man walks past me, pushing a blue plastic barrel filled with scraps. A few workers carve the meat with wizards, small electric knives that have spinning round blades. The wizards look like the Norelco razors that Santa rides in the TV ads. I notice that a few of the women near me are sweating, even though the place is freezing cold. Sides of beef suspended from an overhead trolley swing toward a group of men. Each worker has a large knife in one hand and a steel hook in the other. They grab the meat with their hooks and attack it fiercely with their knives. As they hack away, using all their strength, grunting, the place suddenly feels different, primordial. The machinery seems beside the point, and what's going on before me has been going on for thousands of years. The meat, the hook, the knife, men straining to cut more meat. On the kill floor, what I see no longer unfolds in a logical manner. It's one strange image after another. A worker with a power saw slices cattle into halves as though they were 2x4s, and then the halves swing by me into the cooler. It feels like a slaughterhouse now. Dozens of cattle, stripped of their skins, dangle on chains from their hind legs. My host stops and asks how I feel, if I want to go any further. This is where some people get people sick. I feel fine, determined to see the whole process, the world that's been deliberately hidden. The kill floor is hot and humid. It stinks of manure. Cattle have a body temperature of about 101 degrees, and there are a lot of them in the room. Carcasses swing so fast along the rail that you have to keep an eye on them constantly. Dodge them, watch your step, or one will slam you and throw you onto the bloody concrete floor. It happens to workers all the time. I see a man reach inside cattle and pull out their kidneys with his bare hands, then drop the kidneys down a metal chute, over and over again as each animal passes by him. A stainless steel rack of tongues. Wizards peeling meat off decapitated heads, picking them almost as clean as the white skulls painted by Georgia O'Keeffe. We wade through blood that's ankle deep and that pours down drains into huge vats below us. As we approach the start of the line, for the first time I hear the steady pop, pop, pop of live animals being stunned. Now the cattle suspended above me look just like the cattle I've seen on ranches for years, but these ones are upside down swinging on hooks. For a moment, the sight seems unreal. There are so many of them, a herd of them, lifeless. And then I see a few hind legs still kicking, a final reflex action, and the reality comes hard and clear. For 8.5 hours, a worker called a sticker does nothing but stand in a river of blood, being drenched in blood, slitting the neck of a steer every 10 seconds or so, severing its carotid artery. He uses a long knife and must hit exactly the right spot to kill the animal humanely. He hits that spot again and again. We walk up a slippery metal stairway and reach a small platform where the production line begins. A man turns and smiles at me. He wears safety goggles and a hard hat. His face is splattered with gray matter and blood. He is the knocker, the man who welcomes cattle to the building. Cattle walk down a narrow chute and pause in front of him, blocked by a gate, and then he shoots them in the head with a captive bolt stunner, a compressed air gun attached to the ceiling by a long hose, which fires a steel bolt that knocks the cattle unconscious. The animals keep strolling up, oblivious to what comes next, and he stands over them and shoots. For 8.5 hours, he just shoots. As I stand there, he misses a few times and shoots the same animal twice. As soon as the steer falls, a worker grabs one of its hind legs, shackles it to a chain, and the chain lifts the huge animal into the air. I watch the knocker knock cattle for a couple of minutes. The animals are powerful and imposing one moment, and then gone in an instant, suspended from a rail, ready for carving. A steer slips from its chain, falls to the ground, and gets its head caught in one end of a conveyor belt. The production line stops as workers struggle to free the steer, stunned but alive from the machinery. I've seen enough. I step out of the building into the cool night air and follow the path that leads cattle into the slaughterhouse. They pass me, driven toward the building by workers with long white sticks that seem to glow in the dark. One steer, perhaps sensing instinctively what the others don't, turns and tries to run, but workers drive him back to join the rest. The cattle lazily walk single file toward the muffled sounds, pop, 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 coming from the open door. The path has hairpin turns that prevent cattle from seeing what's in store and keep them relaxed. As the ramp gently slopes upward, the animals may think they're headed for another truck, another road trip, and they are, in unexpected ways. The ramp widens as it reaches ground level and then leads to a large cattle pen with wooden fences, a corral that belongs in a meadow, not here. As I walk along the fence, a group of cattle approach me, looking me straight in the eye, like dogs hoping for a treat, and follow me out of some mysterious impulse. I stop and try to absorb the whole scene. The cool breeze, the cattle and their gentle lowing, a cloudless sky, steam rising from the plant in the moonlight. And then I notice that the building does have one window, a small square of light on the second floor. It offers a glimpse of what's hidden behind this huge blank facade. Through the little window, you can see bright red carcasses on hooks, going round and round. Knocker, sticker, shackler, rumper, first legger, knuckle dropper, navel boner, splitter top bottom butt, feed kill chain. The names of job assignments at a modern slaughterhouse convey some of the brutality inherent in the work. Meatpacking is now the most dangerous job in the United States. The injury rate in a slaughterhouse is about 3 times higher than the rate in a typical American factory. Every year, about 1 out of 3 meatpacking workers in this country, roughly 43,000 men and women, suffer an injury or a work-related illness that requires medical attention beyond first aid. There is strong evidence that these numbers, compiled by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, understate the number of meatpacking injuries that occur. Thousands of additional injuries and illnesses most likely go unrecorded. Despite the use of conveyor belts, forklifts, dehiding machines, and a variety of power tools, most of the work in the nation's slaughterhouses is still performed by hand. Poultry plants can be largely mechanized, thanks to the breeding of chickens that are uniform in size. The birds in some Tyson factories are killed, plucked, gutted, beheaded, and sliced into cutlets by robots and machines. But cattle still come in all sizes and shapes, varying in weight by hundreds of pounds. The lack of a standardized steer has hindered the mechanization of beef plants. In one crucial respect, meatpacking work has changed little in the past 100 years. At the dawn of the 21st century, amid an era of extraordinary technological advance, the most important tool in a modern slaughterhouse is a sharp knife. Lacerations are the most common injuries suffered by meatpackers, who often stab themselves or stab someone working nearby. Tendinitis and cumulative trauma disorders are also quite common. Meatpacking workers routinely develop back problems, shoulder problems, carpal tunnel syndrome, and trigger finger, a syndrome in which a finger becomes frozen in a curled position. Indeed, the rate of these cumulative trauma injuries in the meatpacking industry is far higher than the rate in any other American industry. It's almost 35 times higher than the national average in industry. Many slaughterhouse workers make a knife cut every 2 or 3 seconds, which adds up to about 10,000 cuts during an 8-hour shift. If the knife has become dull, additional pressure is placed on the worker's tendons, joints, and nerves. A dull knife can cause pain to extend from the cutting hand all the way down the spine. Workers often bring their knives home and spend at least 40 minutes a day keeping the edges smooth, sharp, and sanded with no pits. One IBP worker, a small Guatemalan woman with graying hair, spoke with me in the cramped kitchen of her mobile home. As a pot of beans cooked on the stove, she sat in a wooden chair, gently rocking, telling the story of her life, of her journey north in search of work, the whole time sharpening big knives in her lap as though she were knitting a sweater. The IBP revolution has been directly responsible for many of the hazards that meatpacking workers now face. One of the leading determinants of the injury rate at a slaughterhouse today is the speed of the disassembly line. The faster it runs, the more likely that workers will get hurt. The old meatpacking plants in Chicago slaughtered about 50 cattle an hour. 20 years ago, new plants in the High Plains slaughtered about 175 cattle an hour. Today, some plants slaughter up to 400 cattle an hour, about half a dozen animals every minute, sent down a single production line carved by workers desperate not to fall behind. While trying to keep up with the flow of meat, workers often neglect to resharpen their knives and thereby place more stress on their bodies. As the pace increases, so does the risk of accidental cuts and stabbings. "I could always tell the line speed," a former Montfort nurse told me, "by the number of people with lacerations coming into my office. People usually cut themselves. Nevertheless, everyone on the line tries to stay alert. Meatpackers often work within inches of each other, wielding large knives. A simple mistake can cause a serious injury." A former IBP worker told me about boning knives suddenly flying out of hands and ricocheting off of machinery. "They're very flexible," she said, "and they'll spring on you. Zwing, and they're gone." Much like French fry factories, beef slaughterhouses often operate at profit margins as low as a few pennies a pound. The three meatpacking giants, ConAgra, IBP, and Excel, try to increase their earnings by maximizing the volume of production at each plant. Once a slaughterhouse is up and running, fully staffed, the profits it will earn are directly related to the speed of the line. A faster pace means higher profits. Market pressures now exert a perverse influence on the management of beef plants. The same factors that make these slaughterhouses relatively inefficient, the lack of mechanization, the reliance on human labor, encourage companies to make them even more dangerous by speeding up the pace. The unrelenting pressure of trying to keep up with the line has encouraged widespread methamphetamine use among meatpackers. Workers taking crank feel charged and self-confident, ready for anything. Supervisors have been known to sell crank to their workers or to supply it free in return for certain favors, such as working a second shift. Workers who use methamphetamine may feel energized and invincible, but are actually putting themselves at much greater risk of having an accident. For obvious reasons, a modern slaughterhouse is not a safe place to be high. In the days when labor unions were strong, workers could complain about excessive line speeds and injury rates without fear of getting fired. Today, only one-third of IBP's workers belong to a union. Most of the non-union workers are recent immigrants, many are illegals, and they are generally employed at will. That means they can be fired without warning for just about any reason. Such an arrangement does not encourage them to lodge complaints. Workers who have traveled a great distance for this job, who have families to support, who are earning 10 times more an hour in a meatpacking plant than they could possibly earn back home, are wary about speaking out and losing everything. The line speeds and labor costs at IBP's non-union plants now set the standard for the rest of the industry. Every other company must try to produce beef as quickly and cheaply as IBP does. Slowing the pace to protect workers can lead to a competitive disadvantage. Again, workers told me that they are under tremendous pressure not to report injuries. The annual bonuses of plant foremen and supervisors are often based in part on the injury rate of their workers. Instead of creating a safer workplace, these bonus schemes encourage slaughterhouse managers to make sure that accidents and injuries go unreported. Missing fingers, broken bones, deep lacerations, and amputated limbs are difficult to conceal from authorities. But the dramatic and catastrophic injuries in a slaughterhouse are greatly outnumbered by less visible, though no less debilitating ailments: torn muscles, slipped discs, pinched nerves. If a worker agrees not to report an injury, a supervisor will usually shift him or her to an easier job for a while, providing some time to heal. If the injury seems more serious, a Mexican worker is often given the opportunity to return home for a while, to recuperate there, then come back to his or her slaughterhouse job in the United States. Workers who abide by these unwritten rules are treated respectfully. Those who disobey are likely to be punished and made an example. As one former IBP worker explained, they're trying to deter you, period, from going to the doctor. From a purely economic point of view, injured workers are a drag on profits. They are less productive. Getting rid of them makes a good deal of financial sense, especially when new workers are readily available and inexpensive to train. Injured workers are often given some of the most unpleasant tasks in the slaughterhouse. Their hourly wages are cut, and through a wide variety of unsubtle means, they're encouraged to quit. Not all supervisors in a slaughterhouse behave like Simon Legree, shouting at workers, cursing them, minimizing their injuries, always pushing them to move faster. But enough supervisors act that way to warrant the comparison. Production supervisors tend to be men in their late 20s and early 30s. Most are Anglos and don't speak Spanish, although more and more Latinos are being promoted to the job. They earn about $30,000 a year, plus bonuses and benefits. In many rural communities, being a supervisor at a meatpacking plant is one of the best jobs in town. It comes with a fair amount of pressure. A supervisor must meet production goals, keep the number of recorded injuries low, and most importantly, keep the meat flowing down the line without interruption. The job also brings enormous power. Each supervisor is like a little dictator in his or her section of the plant, largely free to boss, fire, berate, or reassign workers. That sort of power can lead to all sorts of abuses, especially when the hourly workers being supervised are women. Many women told me stories about being fondled and grabbed on the production line, and the behavior of supervisors sets the tone for the other male workers. In February of 1999, a federal jury in Des Moines awarded $2.4 million to a female employee at an IBP slaughterhouse. According to the woman's testimony, co-workers had screamed obscenities and rubbed their bodies against hers while supervisors laughed. 7 months later, Monfort agreed to settle a lawsuit filed by the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission on behalf of 14 female workers in Texas. As part of the settlement, the company paid the women $900,000 and vowed to establish formal procedures for handling sexual harassment complaints. In their lawsuit, the women alleged that supervisors at a Monfort plant in Cactus, Texas, pressured them for dates and sex, and that male co-workers groped them, kissed them, and used animal parts in a sexually explicit manner. The sexual relationships between supervisors and hourlies are for the most part consensual. Many female workers optimistically regard sex with their supervisor as a way to gain a secure place in American society, a green card, a husband, or at the very least, a transfer to an easier job at the plant. Some supervisors become meatpacking Casanovas, engaging in multiple affairs. Sex, drugs, and slaughterhouses may seem an unlikely combination, but as one former Monfort employee told me, inside those walls is a different world that obeys different laws. Late on the second shift, when it's dark outside, assignations take place in locker rooms, staff rooms, and parked cars, even on the catwalk over the kill floor. Some of the most dangerous jobs in meatpacking today are performed by the late-night cleaning crews. A large proportion of these workers are illegal immigrants. They are considered independent contractors, employed not by the meatpacking firms, but by sanitation companies. They earn hourly wages that are about one-third lower than those of regular production employees. And their work is so hard and so horrendous that words seem inadequate to describe it. The men and women who now clean the nation's slaughterhouses may arguably have the worst job in the United States. It takes a really dedicated person, a former member of a cleaning crew told me, or a really desperate person to get the job done.